You're listening to a CUNY Radio podcast of BookBeat, presenting readings and discussions with distinguished and emerging authors.
Welcome to BookBeat. I'm Margaret Ramirez. Barbara Winslow is a professor and historian in the School of Education and the Women and Gender Studies program at Brooklyn College. Her new book is a fascinating biography on political trailblazer Shirley Chisholm, entitled Shirley Chisholm, Catalyst for Change. She's also founder and director of the Shirley Chisholm Project at Brooklyn Women's Activism. The book documents Chisholm's life from her upbringing in Barbados and Brooklyn through her historic political career when she became the first black woman elected to Congress to a presidential run in 1972. Welcome to the studios, Barbara.
Thank you. This is a real thrill for me.
So we were just speaking when you came in about how riveting this book is. I finished it in one night, could not stop reading it. And I want to know what led you to write about the life of Shirley Chisholm. What led you to this woman?
Well, what led me to write it was that Carol Birkin, who is a presidential professor from Baruch College in the Graduate Center, is the editor of the series and asked me to write on it. But the real question is, why did I get interested in Shirley Chisholm? And I'm old enough to have remembered her presidential campaign. I'm old enough to have been in a women's liberation group in Seattle, Washington, which sent her campaign $15. And back in those days, that was a lot of money. I even got to shake her hand. And to be very honest, I hadn't thought much about Mrs. Chisholm until I became a professor at Brooklyn College. And I realized that she was a graduate of the college and that she had been unrecognized. And I was trying to develop ideas for projects, and I wanted to do something about women's activism because that's my field. And so I went to my colleagues in the Women and Gender Studies program and suggested we name this new research center after her. And can you imagine my surprise when half our faculty didn't even know who she was? That's the faculty under the age of 40. Because Mrs. Chisholm was out of the political and personal spotlight for so long. So creating the Shirley Chisholm Project of Brooklyn Women's Activism has become a real mission of mine. And because I was so immersed in every aspect of her life, writing this biography was just not only a labor of great love, but a logical extension of all the work I've been doing.
And you note in the introduction that there are two autobiographies on Shirley Chisholm, but you tell us that there have been inconsistencies and significant gaps in her narrative. Could you tell us about a few of those gaps and inconsistencies and what they tell us about her personality?
Well, she wrote one autobiography, which was Unbought and Unbossed, and she wrote that in 1970-71, and I believe she wrote it to prepare herself for her presidential campaign. And like every politician who writes a biography of themselves, there are obviously huge gaps left out. And of course, it ends in 1971. To me, what was fascinating about it was when she writes about the 60s and she talks about all the work she did in trying to get greater black representation in Brooklyn. There's no mention of the March on Washington. There's no mention of Martin Luther King. I don't believe she went on the March on Washington, and I have corroboration from people I interviewed. But you would think that somebody who is trying to write this biography would like to claim, as everybody seems to, including, if you remember, Mitt Romney, that everybody marched with Dr. King. So she doesn't sort of interrogate a lot of these kind of questions that I had to dig a bit deeper to try to figure out.
And you write that one of her most courageous acts was her support for legalized abortion, and that pitted her against civil rights organizations and black nationalist groups. Tell us how she handled that.
Well, just to begin by saying she was a courageous, very courageous woman. And if you remember in the chapter in Barbados, she was a young girl in Barbados at the time of the movement, the anti-colonial struggle. And when I was reading all the Barbadian newspapers, what I found were the people who were writing about the struggle also supported a woman's right to vote, a woman's right to birth control and reproductive health. This is in the 1920s and 30s. So my guess is that she came back to Brooklyn and her family came back to Brooklyn with a different sort of sense of gender and racial pride. In one of the chapters in Unbought and Unbossed, which I reprint in my book, she talks about why she took up the abortion question. And it really was because it dealt with the health of women and children in her neighborhood. Later research has shown that when abortion was illegal, 80% of the women who died from illegal abortions were either African American or Latina. And given that Bedford-Stuyvesant was the blackest district in the political district in the entire United States, it had more African Americans, Afro-Caribbeans than even Mississippi, she was thinking about her constituents' health and her constituents' life. And it was very courageous because at that time, no one in the black freedom struggle supported a woman's right to abortion and to contraception. And she had to take on the argument that birth control and abortion was genocide against the black community, which I think she did very effectively. She said, when so many women die from illegal abortions, that is genocide.
And then she, I guess she kind of took that courage with her, and she decided to run for president in 1972. Now, from your research and what you read about her and what you learned about her, did she expect to win? Why did she decide to run for president?
I just want to say one thing to remind the audience about how courageous this was. The Voting Rights Act was just, well, had passed in 65. So the Voting Rights Act was 7 years old. And when Chisholm campaigned in the South, for example, African Americans had never seen an African American campaigning for the vote. She describes a situation where she's on the steps of a courthouse, standing underneath a statue of a Confederate soldier with a gun. I can't imagine it, but she writes about how so many elderly African Americans came up to her crying and saying they never thought they would live to see the day. I don't believe she felt she could get elected or get the nomination, but she did believe she was the most qualified. And the reason she felt she was the most qualified was that 72 was right. It was the election sort of, you know, the Voting Rights Act had enabled, and the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act had enabled lots of African Americans in the South to vote. There still was the black freedom struggle. There were a lot of young people up in arms. Veterans had come back and were angry at their treatment. There was the women's movement. She believed she was not the black candidate, but she was the candidate to bring these disparate constituencies together to fight for a progressive social agenda for the Democratic Party. When it became clearer and clearer that the tremendous enthusiasm for her campaign was not translated into primary elections and delegate votes, she concentrated mainly on getting delegate votes because she felt with the more delegates she had, the greater political clout she would have at the convention. So it was not a quixotic campaign, and it was not an, you know, egocentric campaign. It really was an attempt to make an impact on the Democratic Party's platform and the decisions it was going to make going into the future.
Right. And as you mentioned, she broke barriers for women and for black politicians alike. Yet her most famous quote was, "Of my two handicaps, being female puts more obstacles in my path than being black." And you note in your book that that quote was taken out of context in the 2008 Democratic primary between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Why do you think that? Why do you think that was taken out of context?
Well, if we go back to that famous primary campaign, the narrative that the press wanted was a white woman against a black man, and that has been the historic trajectory of the abolition movement, as well as the civil rights movement. And there was a famous op-ed piece in the Times pitting Susan B. Anthony against Frederick Douglass, even though the both of them were friends. And, of course, no mention of people like Sojourner Truth, who supported a woman's, in the 19th century, who supported a woman's right to vote and also opposed slavery.
And so I remember writing countless op-ed pieces, editorials, letters to the editor about mentioning Shirley Chisholm, that this wasn't a white woman versus black man. I couldn't get anything published, and I would like to believe it wasn't because I can't write clearly. So I think that was the narrative. And I also wrote about that many of the Clinton and Obama supporters fell into that. Who was the most oppressed? Is it women? Is it, and when women, it would be white women, or was it African Americans? And I think that was really most unfortunate. And it was really most unfortunate, and it created a great deal of animosity, especially within the feminist community, over who one should support and if you were feminist enough or if you were black enough. But it is a narrative that gets played out over and over and over again, and I think a lot of it has to do with the ambivalence many people have about raising the issue of gender.
All right. And at the end of the book, this paragraph that you wrote struck me. I'm just going to read it quickly. When the Brooklyn College Women's Studies faculty met in 2004 to consider naming a research center after her, most did not know she was an alumna. You mentioned this. A few did not even know who she was. Brooklyn College students, some of whom benefited from the SEEK program that she initiated, had never heard of her. And you offer reasons why she was forgotten and erased from memory. Why is that?
Well, there's the first reason is, of course, she's a working class immigrant woman from the African diaspora. So there's gender, race, class, ethnicity, all of which leads to their erasure. She also, and I believe it was because she was a pioneering woman, the first African-American woman, and the only woman for many years in the Congressional Black Caucus. She was not particularly popular among black men, many of the black leaders, and I write a lot about that in the book. And in fact, unfortunately, I have to say that most of the people who gave her the hardest time were black men. This is not all black men, because one of the things I do like to say is that when Al Sharpton was 18 years old, he was her youth organizer for her campaign in New York. And when he spoke about a month ago in Brooklyn, when they were inaugurating the Shirley Chisholm stamp, he gave the most effective, emotional tribute to Mrs. Chisholm I've heard from anybody. It was really moving, and he meant every word of it. Mm-hmm. But I think the older civil rights leaders, they came right out and said, the first person who's got to be running for president is a man. And so I think that the animosity she faced from the black political leaders was a factor. Then also, she leaves Congress in 1982. She does not live in Brooklyn anymore. She teaches at Mount Holyoke and at Spelman, and then she moves to Florida, and she dies in 2005. So for all intents and purposes, from 82 to 05, she's really out of the public spotlight. I mean, she'll make speeches and so forth, but she does not have the same presence that she did when she was in Congress. So that's an understandable reason why she is not remembered.
Right.
But the purpose of writing this book, and of course, I have to do a shout out to Shala Lynch, because her brilliant award-winning documentary, Chisholm 72, Unbought and Unbossed, began bringing Chisholm back into the national discussion.
Right, and that is, I would note that as we close, that is changing. She is kind of rising to prominence now with your book and the U.S. Post Office releasing a stamp. And what is your hope that people get from reading the book?
Well, I hope the book gets into high schools and colleges. And in the book, my thesis is basically Chisholm's life exemplifies urban America post-World War II. That is, it talks about the immigrant experience, the working class experience, the black struggle. Another wonderful historian, Martha Biondi, has made the point that basically the civil rights movement did not necessarily begin in the South, but actually began in Brooklyn. It's a great understanding of how urban politics worked and the importance of the liberal ascendancy as exemplified by the Great Society, and that Chisholm was very much a supporter of the Great Society. It places her in the context of the rise of urban liberalism and then the decline and the neoliberal assault on cities and on the Great Society. So her life is a window into a certain period in U.S. history. And I think that many of my students at Brooklyn College, when they see Shala's video and they read sections from the book, they can identify with Mrs. Chisholm. She could be their great aunt or their grandmother's best friend. She is such a familiar person in the borough of Brooklyn.
Great. So in closing again, Barbara Winslow has written a wonderful book about a remarkable woman, Shirley Chisholm, Catalyst for Change. Thank you once again for joining us here.
Thank you. This was really wonderful.
For more BookBeat, visit CUNY Radio online at cuny.edu/radio. BookBeat is a production of the Office of University Relations.